Hello and welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name is Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. In this episode, Korean Context takes a look at tourism in North Korea. You ever wondered who goes on summer holidays to North Korea, wanted to know more about the companies that take them, or maybe you're keen to know about what you can expect from touring one of the world's most unique destinations? Well, if that's the case, then you're definitely in the right place today. In this special length episode, we answer these questions and more through conversations with the staff of two specialist companies that regularly bring tourists to the DPRK. Simon Cockrell is the general manager of Koryo Tours, a British company that has been bringing Westerners to the DPRK since 1993. He's visited North Korea over 100 times. Walter Keats is president of Asia Pacific Travel, a company that's been bringing tourists to Northeast Asia since the 1970s and has been taking American travelers to North Korea since 1995. So, why visit North Korea? I started by asking Simon from Koryo if he could tell us about why people would want to visit the DPRK. I also asked him to describe the kind of tourists that generally like to go.
Well, there's various reasons for people to go, and I think it really boils down to the fact that because it is there and it manifestly exists, whether we want it to or not, whether our governments recognise it or not, it is there. And you can go there. It's not that difficult. It's not cheap, but the procedure for most people is painless and very smooth. We take a fair number of people who are country collectors, you know, people who've been to, you know, 100-something other places. They just want to visit every country in the world. But that's still a minority. Mostly it's just people who are very interested in the place, because it's not the sort of country that you just stumble into. You don't just decide on a whim to go to North Korea. So it's interesting that most of the people we take are very well read on the subject. They have maybe preconceived ideas, but they have a lot of questions that they want answered. A lot of the people we take already live in East Asia or have some experience there. So a lot of Western people living in Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, etc., and in South Korea too. So for various reasons, but actually the groups we assemble always gel very well because people truly have a common interest, and that's to learn more as much as they can on the spot about what it's like in North Korea.
But while Brits like Simon and I have been able to visit the DPRK relatively unhindered for the past two decades, this has not always been the case for Americans. Until recently, US nationals could only visit North Korea when the Arirang Mass Games were taking place, with itineraries restricted to a few short days and travel into the country only possible by air. However, this all changed in 2010 when DPRK tourism authorities relaxed the rules, allowing Americans to stay for much longer periods and giving them greater flexibility in traveling beyond Pyongyang. I asked Walter Keats about what may have motivated the North Koreans to make these changes.
Well, it appears that they're interested in promoting more tourism. And I've been pushing that myself, saying, this is a legal business. You know, you've got all these sanctions and stuff, but tourism is perfectly legal. There's no problem for Americans to go. The U.S. government has no problem with us.
Not like Cuba.
Nope, not like Cuba. Cuba's the only one where we're really restricted like that.
Yeah.
And so, it just seems to me they ought to be doing more of this. And it, from my point of view, I think it's wonderful because the more both sides know and understand each other and see that we don't have horns and all that kind of stuff, I think that's a wonderful thing.
But while things changed for Americans in 2010, some things bizarrely didn't. Many tourists to North Korea can enjoy an interesting train ride into or out of the country, but Americans are still not allowed and must fly. I asked Walter why he thought this was the case.
Yeah, I would vote for arbitrary on that one, because in 1995 I took the train. And actually in 1995 I was there for 9 days. Went all over, went to Wonsan, went to Kumgang from the north, all this sort of stuff, and left by train. I went out to Shenyang and stuff.
Yeah.
And so, no problem. And somewhere along the line, somebody decided that's some way to stick it to the Americans or whatever. And, but the people you talk to, it's somebody at a much higher level who never meets the foreigners, or where I could have a rational discussion and say, well, now, why is it that you think this is effective? It would be a great tourism draw. Many people would like to take the train. It's just much more relaxing. And you know, one of the problems, even, I mean, when it was 3 days, 5 day limits, the planes leave at 9 o'clock in the morning on the last day. So that's not really a day, you know. You get up, you have breakfast, and you drive to the airport. Big deal. But if you take the train, it leaves at like 10:30 and gets to Sinuiju and Dandong 4:30, 5 o'clock or so.
Yeah.
So you've had a whole day, really a whole full day, a 9-to-5-y kind of thing in North Korea. You see parts of the country you wouldn't have seen otherwise. And a train is great, better than a bus, because you get up, walk around, and all that sort of stuff.
With the changes in tourism for Americans, I wanted to know more about other changes in tourism trends. So I asked Simon to elaborate more on what had changed in administering tours over the years.
It's moved forward incrementally, what look in many ways like big changes, but I think in reality it's not been enough. Every year a few more places become possible to visit, whether they be quite large things like the city of Hamhung and the Kumgang Mountain area last year, or occasionally just one school which will now accept visitors. To me, I'm always hungry for more. I think there should be more places we can go, more cities and countryside areas open to tourists, because although we can visit quite a lot of the country, the majority still we can't see. It's become a bit easier to operate tours there as our partners have become more experienced and the market has grown. So it's very rare for there to be a time when there are no tourists there now, whereas a few years ago it was still possible to show up and be literally the only tourist in a giant hotel. So it's changing, but you know, we always push for a bit more change. We are grateful for the changes that have occurred, but we do want more.
And these new destinations that have been opening up, why do you think that is? Is North Korea letting its guard down a bit more, or is there some other motivation here?
It's hard to say, because the decision-making process is a little bit obscured. I always liken it to kind of like a ladder, where you only know the people one rung above you and one rung below you, and nobody knows how many rungs it's got to go up for a decision to come down, or how many people have the possibility to say no and just, you know, knock the whole thing off the ladder, as it were. Why they open new places, again, a bit of a mystery. I'd love to say it was down entirely to pressure from companies like ourselves, and that may have something to do with it, because we do make request after request after request, and eventually it happens. But still, there appears to be little rhyme or reason. There are some cities that I think would benefit greatly from increased Western tourism. For example, the city of Sinuiju on the Chinese border, which already has a tourism infrastructure, because several tens of thousands of Chinese tourists visit every year on day trips. So they have places for them to visit, they have restaurants, they have, you know, a fixed itinerary already. But yet they won't allow any non-Chinese to even get off the train and walk into town, or even to take these day trips across the border. So there seems no sense in that. Gradually, I think it's becoming a little more reasonable, but again, not fast enough for me.
Walter had some different thoughts as to why these destinations might be opening.
I think some have spread the wealth. I mean, look at in China. I mean, you know, the big complaint in China was that all these coastal cities, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, and some of these places, they were getting all the money. I mean, all the investment, everything was going there, which was logical because you could access with the port and airports and stuff. And what happens to the inland cities? They're all stuck in the mud, you know, and still struggling. And so I think it's probably internal. I mean, it's got less to do with us probably than the fact that these cities, somebody is saying, hey, we need some money. I mean, you know, as you say, if you run down, then you want some money. And tourism is a good way to do that.
But while tourism might be a good way for cities in North Korea to raise money, many think that what visitors see in these destinations is extremely staged, with local authorities only showing tourists what they want foreigners to see. But with these new destinations opening up, I wondered if tourists might now be getting a better understanding of the real North Korea compared to the old itineraries that concentrated exclusively on Pyongyang. Simon gave his 2 cents.
Yeah, I think it's a very fair comment when people say that, but I think it does understate the value of the experience in going there. Even if you went on a tour just to Pyongyang, what people often seem to ignore is that the 2 million or so people who live there, they are real people. And when you see them going about their day, that is what they do. It's not a city full of actors. It's not a Potemkin city. And it's easy to say, well, they, in the monolithic sense, they will let you see what they want you to see. But that can really only be true to some extent, unless literally an entire capital city has been fabricated for the benefit of a couple of thousand tourists, which is, you know, manifestly untrue. There is a plurality of life experience in North Korea. There are a lot of people who are very, very poor, you know, in desperate straits. There is a middle class. There are a few wealthy people. There are a lot of people who fall in between these classifications. So even just visiting Pyongyang, you would see real life, but certainly that isn't representative of the nation as a whole. Similar to any developing country, really, is that there is a centralization of wealth and power. When you go out to other places, whether they be relatively conventional for visitors like Kaesong, or their countryside areas, or their these large east coast cities like Hamhung and Chongjin, then you do see a different lifestyle. But what a lot of people have to realize, and I think the people who go there as tourists do, is that you really have to infer what it's really like. You would be wrong to think that what you see is staged for you, but you would be naive to think that what you see is all there is. And I really don't think that's that complicated a concept for tourists to understand. So I think when that's mentioned, it's a valid point, but I think as a criticism, it's not valid because it doesn't take into account the fact that people who go on tour there are not stupid. They are well aware of this and that they can see between the gaps. And it is possible to talk to people there and ask them about their lives. And unless you're, you know, the embodiment of cynicism, you would have to come back from a trip to North Korea knowing more about what life is like there than you knew beforehand.
Another criticism of travel to North Korea is that it's irresponsible, and that by going, you're actually supporting the perpetuation of a despotic regime. I probed Walter about this to see what he thought.
Just the fact that we're there, whether we're Americans or Brits or Aussies or Chinese or whatever, I think the people, the North Koreans who see us, and the very few then who interact with us, we can't really be at war, can we, if we're really over there doing that, can we? And so I think these are things that help to improve relations so that there are people over time, more and more people who have a more positive image of the outside world and realize we're not planning on an immediate invasion, maybe immediate evasion, but not invasion. So I think that that's very critical. And again, okay, you got all these sanctions. Well, so you keep squeezing them, Isn't that cute? Well, unless your ultimate goal is really the destruction and collapse of the regime, which, frankly, I think is would be a catastrophe for everybody. The Chinese don't want that. They don't want North Korean refugees running across the border there. The South Koreans don't want it. I mean, people want an orderly transition to whatever happens. And so if that's, if we're not looking for just to squeeze them until they're all dead and dying in the streets and collapse, then you need to have some reasonable things. And tourism is a legal activity. It's a great thing. It provides jobs for people. I mean, a whole infrastructure, the hotels, the buses, the guides, the drivers, the waitresses in the restaurants, the food. There's just a ton of things that make tourism a great international goodwill ambassador if done properly. And, I don't think anything they're doing now is improper.
Many analysts and career watchers are weary about the findings and comments made by visitors returning from North Korea. For as already mentioned, there has long been a suspicion that visitors are only shown the best parts of the country. But with remote parts of the DPRK like Hamhung and Chongjin now opening to tourism, I wanted to know if visitors might now be getting a better glimpse of the real poverty that is known to exist in North Korea.
The deeper you go in the countryside, the poorer the areas are that you see. It's hard to say what, real poverty, I guess, is something that is defined, whether it's abject poverty or so on. But yeah, you do see areas that are obviously very poor. You see people whose clothes are no good, land which looks barely viable. Mm-hmm. A lot of what people come back from a tour and say they've seen, maybe they're inferring it rather than seeing it, but that's still valid. The worst areas you see, every tourist knows that there are worse areas. Everybody knows this. This is barely a secret at all. And even the North Koreans we meet there wouldn't deny that there are simply worse areas. So yeah, you do see some poverty, but what you don't see is absolute abject desperation, which you still can perhaps realize that this must exist somewhere a little bit further in. Yeah. But for a very small country with poor quality roads or no roads in some areas, it's very hard for anybody to get around. So even the very you know, the people who specialize in that element of North Korea, even they end up having to do a little bit of guesswork, I think. So it's a very frustrating place to learn anything about. But that's one of the reasons people would like to visit.
Because one of the things I hear from people that come back from North Korea, and it's pretty much all of them, is, oh, it's not actually that bad. Mm. They're expecting it to be a lot worse. The stories of famine and so on, in contrast, people are seeing farms full of crops, mm-hmm. Ready to be harvested. Do you think North Korea is, obviously it wants to show its best side, but do you think that's, I don't know, like it's like a real image that they're mm-hmm. giving, or is it actually worse in the areas that we don't go?
Yeah, that's a good question. It is common for people to come back and say, well, we had more freedom than we expected. It was better than expected. But that really is because when you go there, you expect zero freedom, and then you have some freedom, so therefore it's a gain. It's a little bit of expectation management, I think. And when you visit some farms there, yeah, sometimes, depending on the time of year you go, there is food everywhere. There are crops growing, and people do look healthy and well. But this isn't every farm, and this isn't every farm throughout the year. So, and the tour guides there, they don't really suggest to the tourists that it is like this everywhere, it is like this always. And after all, they don't know themselves, because their job is to take people to certain places. But and certain areas of the country are okay at certain times of the year. So it's very hard to totally generalize, because there's such a range of standards in agriculture across the nation. You can see certainly that it's very, very hard there. You can see that explicitly without needing to infer it. But I don't think anyone who's a tourist there is so naive to think that if they visit at harvest season and they go to a farm in near Pyongyang, in where the arable land is located, that is replicated across a country that's 90% of mountains and, you know, suffers horrific winters, a lot of flooding and so on. Mm-hmm. So I do think people come away thinking it's better than they expected, but it's because they expected something absolutely horrifying.
But while North Korea remains one of the poorest countries in the world, it's nevertheless extremely expensive for Westerners to visit when compared to countries like neighboring China. In contrast, Chinese tourists can enter North Korea for a fraction of the price that Westerners pay. I asked Simon if he could explain the basis of tourism pricing in North Korea.
Competition is a lot of it, I think. There isn't much in North Korea. Different facets of state-owned companies own hotels, restaurants, and so on, but they just charge a very high price. Their airline tickets are quite expensive, train tickets are quite expensive. And it's true that some things there are expensive, even on the world stage. Fuel is expensive because it's all imported. A lot of foodstuffs are expensive. But the question really, that answers it partly, but then when Chinese people are charged less for ground services as tourists, ground services means transportation, service of tour guides, entry fees, hotel and meals. When Chinese people pay a fraction of what Western people pay, that sort of gives the lie to it being just about lack of competition, because if I eat a bowl of rice or Mr. Jiang eats a bowl of rice, I don't think the providers of that rice had to pay any more for it. And, you know, the same as if I lie in a bed or if I turn on a light. So there is an element of what they like to call means testing, which would be charitable, I think. They do just charge Westerners more. People involved in the tourism industry want to make money, and that's the price that they feel the market would bear. Of course, maybe if they halved their prices and that price could be passed on, that reduction could be passed on by companies like ours, maybe there would be a threefold increase in tourists. But then again, maybe there wouldn't. And after all, there are only so many seats on those planes, and they don't fly very often. So the market can't grow that much until there's more infrastructure. But really, you know, in answer to the question, I don't know. They like to make money, and they feel that it can be done, and I guess they're somewhat happy with the amount that they're taking at the moment.
But isn't that bizarre, though, that in the process of, you know, finishing off this Ryugyong Hotel, which, for the listeners who don't know, is this 105-odd floor hotel that's been in building for over two decades now. They've got that hotel. There's many hotels in North Korea with a lot of capacity. But you just touched on something interesting there. There's, what, two or three flights in a week from Beijing with 150-odd seats on the plane. There's two trains each week.
Four trains a week.
But now, you can only bring in maybe 1,000 tourists a week. So
there's 1,001 rooms at the Yanggakdo Hotel. And that's one hotel. There's, you know, a dozen hotels in Pyongyang. So not all the same size.
What's the deal there? Like, what?
It's difficult to say. I mean, the Ryugyong Hotel is clearly a prestige project and was actually started before the Yanggakdo Hotel was started. And then, you know, funding dried up, and for whatever reason they stopped building it, and then but they managed to build another 47-story hotel instead. It is a bit of a mystery. Some of those hotels do sometimes get full because although there aren't many flights and trains, at high season they will add extra flights. There are special trains as well that come in from the Chinese border to bring in many thousands of Chinese tourists, which is their main market. As I may have mentioned before, there's only 2,000 to 3,000 Western tourists per year, but there are vastly more Chinese tourists. And although they pay less as tourists to come, they spend more, because the average Western tourist will buy maybe a T-shirt and an unusual bottle of booze and some books. But the Chinese tourists very commonly spend thousands and thousands of renminbi on ginseng, on celadon porcelain works, on artworks and so on. So they, for the state, bring in much more money. But what the thinking is behind oversupply of hotels, I don't know. Maybe it's they're just planning ahead. Who knows, really? But yeah, it's a long-term plan, perhaps.
Moving on, I wanted to find out more about the tour guides that work with Westerners in North Korea. I put it to Walter that three adjectives summed up what outsiders thought about them: strict, controlling, and unbending.
You know, the problem in North Korea is that it is the responsibility system. I mean, definitely there's this chain of command. And, you know, we all tend to think, well, if I, you know, go get drunk and kill somebody, you know, then that's my problem, you know. But it doesn't work that way. I mean, in North Korea, the guides, they are responsible for you. And so if you do something bad, they're going to get in trouble. And it also is that their families can be in trouble, too. So, I mean, it can really balloon very rapidly, so that problems are not something that you want to start, because it gets way out of hand real quickly. And so I think the key is to have a good relationship with these guys, so that they see you're not threatening or endangering them, you know. And so if you go there with a good open mind that you're all on the same team, I mean, you're not really on the same team, but you understand that, and you're not there to endanger them. You would like to do these different things, but not at any danger to them. So as long as you do that stuff and you get a good relationship, these guys have been very cooperative about everything. I mean, photographs, I mean, in the past they would sort of say, well, you're in the bus, no pictures from the bus. Well, it's because they got to tell you that, you know. But as long as nobody causes any trouble, I mean, if you don't take pictures you're not supposed to of the military or any bad things, then there's no problem. But if they didn't tell you that, then that's sort of a fault on their part, too. So it may sound more strict than it is at this point. I mean, you know, and you certainly can bump into walls real quick if you start pushing the envelope. You'll find some of these things.
But with guides working so closely alongside foreigners, I wondered whether tourists were having any real impact on the character or makeup of the guides. Simon explained.
Now, some of these guides are excellent. Some of them are not so good. You know, we try and choose as much as possible who we get, at least especially for our larger groups or very specialist groups. But really their level of English and their level of ability to engage with their customers has improved greatly. They understand more jokes. They're a lot more willing to discuss the things that the tourists want to discuss. Because whereas it's in their job description to tell you how high every mountain is and how many blocks are in the Juche Tower and what that represents, quite often the tourists want to talk about a combination of political issues and more everyday things about what everyday life is like. And so they dissemble a lot less. They're a lot more honest and straightforward now. So I think that that's been a big leap forward. And I think they're influenced by the tourists, because you notice that the tour guides who deal with a lot of British groups have all developed this slightly dry sense of humor. The tour guides who deal with Chinese groups have developed very loud voices and very uncompromising attitudes. Whatever's needed to get along with their charges, basically.
A common perception in the West is that the guides are sons and daughters of elite figures within North Korean society. I asked Simon about the hiring process.
It's varied because there are guides of various different ages. A lot of the middle-aged men who are guides are from very simple backgrounds, some people from the countryside, some from Pyongyang. Most of them I know, you know, men I'm talking in their 40s and 50s, they learned English while in the army doing national service. A lot of them have been abroad to usually African countries working as translators on infrastructural projects. And when they've come back, this is a vocation, a skill they've got, translating. So they've moved into that field. These days, a lot of the younger guides, I mean, predominantly women, but also a lot of men in their 20s, they've been to the the Pyongyang School of Foreign Studies, or they've been to the Tour Guides Training College, a vocational school, to learn these skills specifically. Some of them are from very privileged backgrounds, some of them with quite prominent families, and then some with very simple backgrounds. So it is quite a mix, and it is interesting to see that these people, they do get along. Where, you know, the popular image we have of North Korea is it's very strictly hierarchical with people of different classes, different backgrounds. But people in the travel industry, which isn't a major industry after all, they do seem to get along. And there are bosses who are, you know, grew up in the countryside, who are perfectly willing to boss around the grandchildren of people who are fairly important there. So that's a good sign, I think.
As anyone who watches the peninsula knows well, Mount Kumgang has been the centre of a dispute between North and South Korea since 2008, when a 53-year-old South Korean tourist was shot and killed by North Korean soldiers as she walked along the resort's beach. Following the incident, South Korea demanded an investigation, but North Korea declined, leading Seoul to cancel all trips to Kumgangsan. Likely annoyed by the loss of what had previously been a significant revenue earner, the government in North Korea tried and failed several times to renegotiate South Korean access to Kumgang. This culminated in the warning last year that North Korean authorities would reclaim all of Hyundai Asan's facilities if South Koreans were not allowed back to the resort. With this threat failing to achieve its desired objective, North Korea controversially expropriated all of Hyundai Asan's property, also cancelling their right to be the sole operator of tours there. Despite this, and very loud warnings from the South Korean government, tours to Kumgang continue to take place, albeit now from North Korea. I asked Walter Keats whether or not it was true that his company had started conducting tours there.
I mean, I wouldn't claim this is a trend or anything. We went there, you know, and, you know, it's a place in North, it's a North Korean area. It's not South Korea, you know. So it's a site in North Korea, just as Chilbo or Paektusan or Kuala or some of these other places. So, but the question is who has the ownership or control of it, et cetera, is certainly a thing. But you go to North Korea, you should expect that you could go to Kumgang. I mean, I've argued with both sides because, as I say, I've been going to Kumgang since 2000 via the south. Mm. And in 95, I was in Kumgang before Mr. Chung, you know, so I got there first, you know. And I never understood why they never allowed tourists to go from the north. It seemed to me was a logical thing that you could have. I mean, the vast majority, there's 2 million South Koreans over the 10 years that went there from the south, and I think it was maybe about 10,000 foreigners is all, but they still, you know, they all went from the south. It just seemed logical to me that they should allow tourists to come from the north also. I mean, it's North Korean territory, you know. I mean, nobody's claiming it owned by Hyundai Asan. I mean, they have a lease or whatever you want to call it, but it's obviously North Korean territory and stuff. And for some reason, that never caught on. I mean, it seemed very simple. I mean, we go to South, go in that way. We pay money to actually Hyundai Asan, or you can buy it from travel agents and stuff. So there are people who are arranging this. Why is KITC any different from that? Why shouldn't you be able to just go to KITC and they pay money to Hyundai for coming in there and pay for the hotels and all that? I mean, that would just be a logical thing anywhere else in the world. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, they never worked it out. And to me, that's what I would hope would be part of what will happen here. I mean, the problem is it's not Hyundai Asan. The problem is the two governments got involved there. And so poor Hyundai Asan is stuck in the middle, and it's just a tragedy. I've got friends there and, you know, all that. But what we just went, and part of it was to see what was the condition there. And unfortunately, as we were planning that, that's when all the additional garbage happened. This guy in New York, Steve Park or whatever, who said he's signing some memorandum of understanding to get investors to do it, which I find it hard to believe he's going to get anybody. And then just as we were getting there, then I guess the North Koreans kicked out the final. There were Hyundai Asan caretakers, I guess, in each of the buildings and things, sort of maintaining stuff, and they all got kicked out. So that all happened after we had planning to go there. I talked to the Hyundai Asan people. They had no problem with us doing that. I even actually, what I'm doing is because, again, I think it's their property. So we've actually set aside money to give to Hyundai Asan to pay for us having gone there and used it.
But did
even though we paid the North Koreans too. So I mean,
did Hyundai Asan explicitly invite you to do that? Or
No. But you know, when I talked to them, I said, "Well, do you have any problem with us doing that?"
Yep.
No, because there are also lots of people. I mean, the Chinese are doing it. All. I mean, there's various groups.
So what exactly are you offering? Stays in Kungang
if somebody wants to do it. I mean, it's going to be very few people because, again, how do you get there? It's four hours to Wonsan. You have lunch, and then it's another 2 or 3 hours to get down there, and then you got to do the same coming back. So most people don't have time. So it's almost a moot point.
Yeah.
And who wants to go there most are the South Koreans. None of them are allowed in, so that's not going to happen.
But given the South Korean government position on this, you know, they've been actively discouraging people to go there. Do you think it's constructive to bring people there, given South Korea's position on this at the moment?
Actually, I wouldn't claim to have a real position yet. I mean, all this has sort of happened the last month or so that this has really changed significantly. We were set to go. I felt it was worthwhile for me, who has been there many times, to see what is the conditions there, you know. When I initially had talked to the North Koreans, you know, they've been saying Kumgang for a while, and people were supposedly going to Kumgang, but I think all they were doing was really going to Wonsan and staying in one of the hotels there, and then doing this hour and a half or 2 hour commute to like a northern area of Kumgang. I don't think, as far as I can tell, they didn't actually go all the way in and do the Kuryong waterfall and the Samulpo Lake and all these sorts of things, as far as I could tell. And I think the problem was a lot of these people had never been there, so they all said they went to, you know, it's a mountain range. You say the Rocky Mountains, it's a big area, you know, but that's not Rocky Mountain National Park or Yellowstone or whatever. So it's not clear, all these people who said they went to Kumgang in the past, whether they really were in the, let's say, the inner sanctum that was really the Hyundai Asan area, or whether they just were in a different, I mean, it's a bunch of mountains. So there's beautiful stuff, you know, just like Chilbo is a pretty extensive area. And so that was part of what I wanted to see is could we, I didn't want to just go to northern Kumgang stuff. I wanted to see people to see this beautiful mountain stuff.
Yeah.
And initially then they said no, and then they said yes, and then was sort of like no again, and it turned out, I guess Hyundai Asan turned off the electricity.
Yeah.
And stuff. So then you really couldn't stay in the hotels, and the hot spring doesn't work, and there's no acrobats and all this. So all kinds of things had been going back and forth. So it was very hard to figure out what was going on. And to me, the thing was, well, let's go see if we can see it. And that's what we did. We may have a few people in the future who want to go, but I wouldn't describe it as regular tours.
Sure.
And we're certainly not investing in anything like that.
But of course, like Hyundai invested politically a lot and financially a lot in this project. And, you know, you might have seen Marcus Noland and Steph Haggard's blog Witness to Transformation.
Right.
And
where they even mentioned me.
Yeah, they mentioned you. And talking of your, you know, your paying fee to Hyundai, they said, "We were almost swayed by Keith's contact with Hyundai Asan, but in the end, we believe that the company may not be acting in either South Korea's or the company's best interest. This is exactly the kind of divide-and-conquer tactics that the North Koreans are hoping will open the door to wider use of the Kumgang site, with or without Hyundai Asan."
Right.
Yeah. Do you think that's true?
It could be. But, again, this is 2 years, you know, and nothing's happened. I find it hard to believe they're going to find an investor. Because, again, who is the market? It's South Koreans. They really are interested. They have the money, and they're right there, you know. It's like us going to Mexico or something from the U.S. Even the Chinese, I mean, they got Wangshan, you know, Taishan. I mean, they got lots of wonderful mountains in China. So why are they going to go all the way over there? 4 hours to Wonsan, lunch, 2 hours or more to get down there, and they got to do the same back. That's, I mean, the Chinese aren't big mountain people. The Chinese are city people, you know. I mean, you know, they really aren't into that kind of stuff so much. And so I just find it hard to believe that they're going to find a real market sufficient to for any investor to do anything. So I think that this is just going to keep on going like this until hopefully there's a resolution and hopefully this stuff goes back to Hyundai Essan, which is where it ought to be.
So basically Hyundai Essan have the most suitable market for this destination.
Right. And the capability, everything. Everything is says that that was the best solution, other than, in my opinion, they should open it up and let people from the north come in and pay a fee to Hyundai Essan during that 50 years.
I also asked Simon to articulate Corio Tour's position on visiting Kumgang.
Well, we've been taking tourists since the middle of last year to Mount Kumgang from the North Korean side. We haven't been staying overnight there in the Kumgangsan zone. We actually use a hotel that's just outside, maybe 45, 50 minutes drive north of the boundary into that zone. The reason being that we're just not entirely clear on what the legal situation is there, as I think most people aren't. We know there's a debate raging between, you know, the North Koreans, who say that they've basically nationalized the property and taken it all back, and then Hyundai, who say, well, you know, we have a contract and we constructed these things. So we basically like to stay out of that. It's above our pay grade, really. So while we're happy to take people into that area, and it's increasingly popular because it's a beautiful area, it's quite well known as well, we don't use the hotel there. And of all the shops and so on that were there, they're not open anyway. So we literally just use the hiking paths and that's it, drive in and drive out.
Ending my conversation with Walter, I thought I'd ask him about what he hoped for the future of tourism in North Korea.
Hopefully both countries will be more friendly and all this stuff will be back open and they will do these sorts of things. Actually, to me, I mean, one of the things I've complained to the North Koreans about is the current situation means who benefits? The Chinese, because we have to go through Beijing. You got to pay, as Americans, $140 to get a visa, whether it's single, double, whatever. To me, because I like Korea, you know, so I want to take people on tours to Korea, which includes Seoul and Gyeongju and all this sort of stuff, too. So what do you do? The biggest airport, always is rated as one of the finest in the world, is in Incheon. Plenty of flights from the U.S. You can fly to Seoul, you spend some time there, see that. Then you get in your bus and you drive up through the DMZ, through Panmunjom, you go to Kaesong, spend time, you go to Pyongyang, you can go to Nampo or one of these different places, you know, whatever, but you make a big circle. Then you go to Wonsan and Kumgang and come back to Seoul. That is the most logical itinerary to see Korea, and that's what I would really like to do.
And here was Simon's opinion of where tourism might be in about 5 or 10 years in North Korea.
I would like to hope, I don't really have a prediction, to be honest. I would like to hope that a lot more places would be possible to visit. I'd like to hope you'd be allowed to travel there without having to have a tour guide all the time. Because, let's be fair, that is a restriction and that is a bit of an annoyance. But at the same time, it's good to have a tour guide in a lot of cases. These people, they know a lot. They have a lot of information to impart. They're good at taking you around. They're good at the logistics of the trip. There is a language barrier. There is a culture barrier and so on. But then that's true of any country, really, aside from North Korea, that you can go there and you can join a tour group or you can not. Or you can do a middle ground. You can book a hotel through a travel company, but then spend half of the days wandering around doing your own thing. I'd like to see it evolve into something like that. And we've been told, oh, wouldn't that destroy your business? But I think greater freedom there would bring prices down, would put the market up. And at the moment, we control a very big piece of a very small cake. I'd rather control a small piece of a much bigger, more open cake.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this special episode on tourism to North Korea. If you'd like to find out more about Corio Tours, visit their website at www.coriogroup.com. And if you'd like to find out more about Asia Pacific Travel's North Korea services, visit NorthKorea111.com, and that's the number one, not word. If you have any questions or comments, then please leave us some feedback on our website. You can find it at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. There's a star system where you can rate the podcast there, Or alternatively, you can look us up on iTunes and rate us there or leave a review. Make sure you tell your friends about it, and if you have any suggestions for people to talk to, then do let me know. My email is ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.